We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you here. And we're also very pleased to have on this program, for the very first time in the year 2010, not for the first time ever, no, for the first time this year, May Barenbaum. She is head of the Department of Entomology here at the University of Illinois. She's a scientist who specializes in studying insects. And so occasionally she's here on the program and we talk about that. And the thing that I always say right up front here is we're not about extermination here. We're about appreciation. So insect questions are welcome. And she always does her best to talk a little bit about bugs that people have seen. They have questions about them and their lives. Well, we can do that. But at this time of year, she usually is here so that we can talk about an event now which has acquired worldwide fame. And, of course, we're talking about the Insect Fear Film Festival, which is coming up this weekend. So she'll talk a little bit about what's up for the festival. And then, certainly, if people have questions, they are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, it's good to see you again.
Always a pleasure.
So 27 years now this
Amazingly
has been going
enough.
On. It's unbelievable. Maybe, again, I'm sure you've told the story, but you might tell a little bit of the story of how this thing got started.
Well, actually, the Insect Fear Film Festival was an idea I had as a graduate student at Cornell when I was walking across the campus and I saw a poster advertising a Godzilla film festival for the Asian American Student Society. And I thought, well, if the Asian American students can have a sense of humor about their identity, why can't entomologists? Mm-hmm. So we could show bad insect science fiction films. So I approached the department head. His name was Ed Smith, and he was appalled. And he said, well, you can show some documentaries and do some lectures. And I thought, that's not the idea at all. So I shelved the thought until I came here and then worked a couple of years as an assistant professor to establish my credentials as a serious scientist. And then I approached our department head here and the same idea. And not only was he enthusiastic, he thought we should charge admission and get a TA line out of it. But I thought, yeah, we'll be lucky to get the seats filled. So with his blessing, we went ahead. And actually, I didn't know anything about doing any kind of film festival. So I sent a note to the head of the unit for cinema studies here on campus, inviting them to co-sponsor. And the head of the unit gave it to his assistant director, who wrote back a very nice letter explaining that they're very busy that semester with French and German retrospectives, but that he'd be happy to help me organize the festival. Long story short, 6 years later, I married him. And I like to point out that the Insect Fear Film Festival gets a bigger crowd than any unit for cinema studies, French or German retrospective ever has.
Which I'm sure he appreciates very much, yes.
So this is our 27th year, and still going strong, and it's just a great deal of fun. We are now widely imitated, but we are the original, the first, and the longest continuous public university celebration of insects in the country. I can't say the longest continuous public celebration of insects because the Banner Elk Woolly Worm Festival is a year older than our Insect Fear Film Festival.
Mm-hmm.
Banner Elk, North Carolina.
You can now claim to be the parents of a lovely daughter and of a film festival.
We're even written up in some books about film festivals, amazingly enough. So.
Okay. So I tell you what, we have a caller. We can talk with them, and we will also talk about some of what's up for this year's festival, including giant scorpions and killer trilobites. Now, if that won't bring people out, I don't know what will.
It's unique.
All right. Let's talk with the caller here, Champagne, line number one. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm. Hello.
I have been hearing about a bed bug infestation in New York, and I'm sure if it's there, it may be other places as well. So I have some general questions about bed bugs. How big are they? What do they look like? friend a million years ago said, oh, you can tell if you have a bed bug bite because it's a two-prong bite.
Yeah, I don't know about the two-pronged. I mean, a lot of things have paired mouth parts. But yes, we are in the throes of a bed bug resurgence. Bed bugs are human ectoparasites. They are, you know, they feed externally on human blood. They don't live on the body like body lice do, or like head lice. Actually, fleas don't spend a whole lot of time on the body either. Not quite as much as like head lice do, which never leave human bodies. Unless they're sort of inadvertently carried off on a scarf or something. But bed bugs live in cracks and crevices and in mattress covers and under beds and the like. They are extremely flat. It's called dorso-ventral, top to bottom flattened, and quite small, I'd say. Is that like about a quarter of an inch there? And very round and
can you see them with the naked eye?
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah. Pale brownish unless they're full of blood. And they're wingless and they really don't look like much of anything else. But they are hard to see. It's much easier to see the results of their feeding. So what I routinely do now, every time I go to a hotel, is check to look for little bits of blood debris because they'll feed at night and excrete on the sheets, and it's really, really hard to see them. And they are, you know, for years they were an anomaly. When I was in graduate school taking entomology classes, I'd never seen them. I never met anyone who'd seen a live one. And then about 15 years ago, I got one in the mail. It was alive too. This was somebody whose father knew my father, who knew that I was an entomologist, and they'd bought a mattress, and these things crawled out of it, and could I tell what they were? And I was like, on the one hand, thrilled. It's a live bed bug. Looks just like the pictures. On the other hand, I was appalled. It's a live bed bug. But what's happened?
It had a new mattress, and it had it?
No. This was a used mattress. What's apparently happened? During the 50s and the 60s, bed bugs were kind of inadvertently suppressed due to widespread use of chlorinated hydrocarbons, you know, like DDT and chlordane and other household chemicals. But then either they developed resistance or the shift to other forms of household chemical pest control allowed them to build their numbers back up. And another major contributing factor is globalization of travel. So many places in the world where bed bugs never stopped being a problem, and now there's an increased frequency. They are very, very good at getting into backpacks and suitcases. They're very flat when they haven't been feeding, and they're really hard to see. And they first started showing up, interestingly, in the 5-star hotels. The first lawsuit I'm aware of in the U.S. involving bed bugs was I think in Chicago, in one of the hotels on the Magnificent Mile.
Mm-hmm.
The Plaza in New York, in London, one of the high-end hotels was involved in lawsuits because this is where international travelers often tend to stop. But now it's the number one reason for pest control calls in New York City now. I think it's outstripped cockroaches. I guess cockroaches are more the devil you know than the devil you don't know. Now, the good news is they don't seem to spread any human diseases, unless you consider revulsion. they are a nuisance. The bites are itchy, and they are kind of, well, there are people whose social interactions have been disrupted because once people know you have bed bugs in your house, they don't want you coming into their house because they can hide in clothes, they can hide in
that's
suitcases.
What I was going to ask. As a child, we had, and I'm very old, we had lice, you know, travel from one coat to another in cloakrooms. How do they travel if you're not staying at a hotel?
Oh, well, they can get in, and they basically can move on human goods. So people don't live in hotels, so they can go, you know, when they eventually get home, they may carry bed bugs home. They live in apartments in New York. They're not just in hotels.
Right.
And they're really difficult to control. at least in part because they live in cracks and crevices and don't often come out, and they don't feed on the body. I mean, they don't remain on the body like head lice do.
And their bites are itchy.
Their bites are very itchy, I'm told. Fortunately, I've not yet been bitten
by
a bed bug.
Yes. Yeah. So we have to be careful in whose home we go because they can attach themselves to our clothes.
Well, they don't really attach. They just kind of hide. Uh-huh. I think people who are infested would know they're infested, and any, I think, civilized host would give you a heads up on that. So.
Even if I don't stay overnight or anything, it could be.
They're usually confined to bedrooms. Just because that's where the meals are. They only come out at night. They're not particularly well defended or robust. Mm-hmm. So they're stealth blood feeders. So they just kind of insert their proboscis. You can't really, it doesn't wake you up or anything. It would sort of blow their whole routine if they woke up when they were feeding.
Right. And it's not a double prong.
Well, they're very small. I think it would be kind of hard to see the – I mean, they do have paired – actually, no. It would be less likely to be double-pronged because they have a – they're true bugs. The entomologists reserve the name bug for members of the order Hemiptera, and they have sort of fused, piercing, sucking mouth parts. So they're less likely to leave – spiders would be more likely to leave two little spots than a bed bug would be.
Really?
Spiders at least have paired jaws or chelicerae. But bed bugs have a proboscis, a little fused, piercing.
So it's just one.
Yeah. But it's be very small. I mean, they're like a fifth to a quarter of an inch long, so their mouth parts would be correspondingly smaller. It would be really, really hard to see, especially if you have any kind of reaction and it's even scratching the bite, so which would be hard not to do because they're very itchy.
Well, I thank you so much. I've been hearing about bed bugs, and I didn't know anything about them, and I'm happy to say I've not experienced them.
Yeah, I don't wish them on anyone.
But I thought I'd better find out
now
what
the bed
it's
bug,
all about.
There are all kinds of cultural things. Bed bugs may actually have been the sort of nominate insect that the word bug was coined with respect to. It's from a Welsh word meaning hobgoblin or beast of the night. So they may have been the archetypal bug, actually.
Well, I thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call. Well, let me introduce again our guest for anyone, if there is anyone still listening. May Barenbaum is here with us. She's head of the Department of Entomology here at U of I and is here about this time of year. We've been doing that for a while so that she could talk a little bit about the Insect Fear Film Festival.
And I'm very grateful for the opportunity.
It's tomorrow.
Yes, it is.
Well, we'd like to see you anyway. You know, we'd have, if it wasn't for the festival, we'd still have you on the show. But for, at this particular time of year, the reason is to talk about the festival, which is tomorrow. Is that right?
Yeah. Tomorrow night, February 27th, our 27th. So it's the 27th festival on the 27th. And I have to say it really speaks well to WILL that they're having a show about insects in the depth of
in
winter.
In the dead of winter?
Yeah, so.
Well, there's still – well, I know I still see some in my house. In fact, I always think about asking you, and I don't know if I ever get around to doing it in the wintertime. My wife and I, we both say – because we occasionally still see Asian lady beetles in the house. So we always ask each other, of course, we say, well, I know who to ask that question. We ask, you know, you wonder, how did they manage to live? What are they eating? How are they existing in the house, which seems to be a kind of sterile environment? Of course, I'm sure it's not.
Actually, it is because late Asian lady beetles aren't the only ones that do this. Most of our temperate species ladybugs spend the winter in a state called diapause, and that is kind of like a hibernation state. Most insects, I think that's a fair thing to say, spend their diapause in the immature stages, like their eggs or their pupae, these sort of states of suspended animation where you don't have to wonder what they're eating or how they're moving around because they don't. They're these sort of immobile stages. But ladybugs, including multicolored Asian ladybugs, overwinter as adults. And it's not the same sort of diapause because they're not kind of immobile. They can move around, but they are – everything is sort of scaled down. They don't eat. They don't have any interest in sex. They don't – so they're reproductively not, ready. And they just hang out. They have stored reserves just like the, the pupae or the eggs or even the caterpillars that are spending the winter in diapause, they build up these fat stores during the fall and live off the fat stores without feeding until the weather gets a little better and they can head outdoors and start looking for aphids again. So they don't need much, just a surface to kind of rest on. They are a nuisance in the house and they smell bad. Well, I guess you shouldn't hold that against them. They can stain the walls because they produce this defensive secretion, which is offensive, I guess, because it smells bad. And but eventually, if the humidity and temperature are appropriate, they'll survive and then leave the house in the spring. Some of the native species overwinter in under tree bark and in huge aggregations, and the aggregations actually help them maintain the appropriate humidity for surviving at this sort of reduced metabolic rate. So what we're seeing kind of is a short-circuited overwintering strategy, which should have them up on the cliffs in China, and instead they're in the wall of the master bedroom. So,
Well, they managed to make it work for them. So I guess that's okay. Let's talk with somebody else here in Urbana. We have a caller, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Dr. Berenbaum, I'm hoping you can identify the loudest insect in the late summer night around here. It's louder than all the katydids and crickets put together. And it's quite harsh sound. It's not a cicada because it starts up after the cicadas have stopped in the late summer. At the risk of embarrassing myself, it goes something like,
and
on and on.
Now that sounds to me a little like a katydid.
It's quite a harsh, loud sound.
Well, I can tell you where you can go. Katydids do have that. There's the traditional, and again, forgive me, you know, sort of the katydid, katydid, you know, the three katydid, 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 but some of them are just did, or didn't, you know.
Oh, okay.
They make the sound by scraping a peg on one wing over a file on another wing, and that sound is technically called stridulation.
Okay.
Which is actually the Latin word for to make a harsh sound. So it's supposed to sound really harsh. Now, if there's a wonderful website you can go to and you can actually compare all the singing insects of North America.
Oh.
And it's called Singing Insects of North America.
.com?
And it's, it's at University of Florida. It should be relatively easy to find. It's if you just type in University of Florida Singing Insects of North America, it should come up. Tom Walker is the entomologist who put it together, and it's just a brilliant site. It shows the range maps. It talks about the life histories, but most importantly, you can click and hear exactly what the call sounds like
at
various temperatures too. So, because typically crickets and katydids will respond to temperature. They'll speed up when it gets warm, and they'll slow down when it gets cold. So you can really pretty much map his. I see David's on the computer.
Their address is at the entomology department at at University of Florida. I think is what it is. But what I did was just what May said. Just put into the browser "singing insects of North America" and it went. And no problem finding it. It was the first thing that comes up.
Oh, all right.
And the one thing you can't do, like on some of the iPhone apps, is hum into your iPhone and it will tell you the ID. But I would start with katydids and start clicking and see if you hear that sound.
All right. Thanks.
All right. Thank you for the call. And it starts it right here. And the first thing it says is, how do you determine if an insect is a cricket, katydid, or cicada? So you could start there, and then to identify an unknown cricket, katydid, or cicada, and so forth and so on. So I'm sure it has a lot of information there, in addition to being able to hear what the sounds.
Yeah, it's a wonderful site. They've done just a superb job. It's very useful.
All right. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455 and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's talk with someone in Champaign. Line two. Hello.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I have a question about something that the Terminix man just calls a strange foreign beetle, and he says that's the real name of it.
Does Did he say odd beetle or
no,
strange beetle?
Strange foreign beetle.
I know the odd beetle. That's a very which is, in fact, a very odd beetle. But strange beetle's a new one on me. Did he tell you more about it? Where did you find it?
No. Actually, it started in some cans of dog treats that my husband had been keeping next to the bed. And suddenly we had these little tiny things that almost looked like they're kind of oval-shaped and very, very small and a light brown. And they just infested various areas of the bedroom. And he just called them a strange foreign beetle.
Well, that's, I'm afraid that's a new one on me. I can tell you about the odd beetle, which has similar life history. It feeds on sort of, I guess you could call it kind of inanimate animal protein. So dog biscuits would be certainly fair game. And they live on museum specimens. And one of the things that makes this odd beetle so odd is that it is capable, when there's not enough food, of molting and getting progressively smaller instead of progressively bigger, which you would think would not be a good thing. And very few other insects are capable of that. But I have to say, I'm going to have to go back to the to my books and see strange beetle. I mean,
do these odd beetles look a little like the way I described?
Yeah, they're, I wouldn't call them minute. They are small.
No, they're bigger than fleas.
Yeah, okay, well.
So maybe it is the odd beetle.
Yeah, I've seen only one publication on the odd beetles by a guy named Jim Mertens at Iowa State, who described this retrograde molting. And they're not very common, but where you do find them is where there's sort of stored animal material.
Is there any way to get rid of them?
That's when you call Phil Nixon, the extension entomologist. And in fact, if this is a new wave of, you know, of stored product pests, he would know. In fact, I'm now really curious because I just gave my lecture in my Insects and People class about stored product pests. And if there's a new one, I need to update my lecture. So, but Phil Nixon is at the he's the extension entomologist here,
right?
Who keeps track of whatever's bothering people in the state, and we'll probably know better. It's very tricky to get rid of something that lives on food, even for animals, because you don't want to use anything poisonous. So,
right.
Some of the stored product pests, pantry pests, like you know the Mediterranean flower moth or the flower beetles can be controlled with species-specific pheromones, but I don't know if the strange beetle has a pheromone trap already designed for it. So I'm sorry to let you down, but that's the best I can – closest to strange I can come is odd.
It probably is just the odd beetle, but I'll contact Dr. Nixon. I hadn't even thought of that.
That would be great, and then I will – right after the show is over, I'll go see if I can find out more about the strange beetle.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
I think some of those things can actually be controlled by freezing them. So if you have something that you can, if you can stick it in your freezer, that might be a way to kill them without using any pesticide or anything like that. If you don't, you know, want to get into spraying chemicals.
It depends on how big the dog is and the dog food bag. So, so if you know, it's not a 50-pound bag of what is that? Old Roy from Walmart. Then,
well, of course, with the weather we're having now, you could just
set
stick
it outside
that and that might
true.
Well take care of it.
Very
too.
True.
All right. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. We're about midway through here, talking with May Barenbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I, author of a number of books. You head down to the bookstore wherever you buy your books, and you can find some of her work. And I do also want to mention here that she recently was the recipient for 2009 of the Public Understanding of Science and Technology Award from the American Association for the Advancement of Science. I think, did you just get that last weekend?
On Saturday, yeah. That's why I was out of town. So
excellent. So I just want to make sure, we have May here on the show, and we goof around, and we have a great time with her. But I just want to make sure that people know that she is a very accomplished and highly regarded scientist in her field, and does a lot of very important work in the field of entomology. And we're just lucky she's willing to come over and sit here and hobnob with us a couple times a year.
Well, turnabout is fair, or whatever, how you say thank you, reciprocity. The award was for public communication of science, and WILL AM Focus 580 was my very first opportunity to communicate with the public. 1982, I think, was the first time I was on the show. And I can't even count the number of times I've been on since, so I have to thank WILL for the chance. I mean, how many radio stations would think that insects could be entertaining, you know?
I don't know. And I got
it. Foreign grain beetle. Here it is. That's what it is. That must be what it is. Yeah, sorry about that. I just was using my iPhone here. That's why it wasn't strange. It was foreign. And it's very small, 16th of an inch. It's the same family as a sawtooth grain beetle. Yeah, that makes sense. But it doesn't have sawtooth pronotum. All right. Frequently problems in new houses, but not with grain. That's got to be what it is. It's not the strange beetle. It is the foreign grain beetle. So,
okay.
But the advice still goes: call Phil if you want to know how to get rid of it. But freezing's not a bad idea.
Yeah, I think that might be. At least it's a pesticide free approach.
Yeah.
Just one other thing, because whenever we talk about you in our house, my wife and colleague Celeste Quinn likes to remind me that it was her idea to have you on.
I never
knew
that.
Yes, it was her idea. So anytime we talk about what a great thing it is to have May on the show, she says, and don't forget, that was my idea.
Well, I should send her a box of candy or something. Right. This got me on the path here to public understanding of science. Well, and also to the listeners. Again, I don't know how many communities there are that could keep this thing going. And, again, dead of winter, it's 18 degrees out, and we're getting calls about insects. So this is probably among the most insect-savvy communities in North America, I would venture to say. Right. So thank you, everybody, for being interested in insects.
So everybody stop off tomorrow. Insect Fear Film Festival is it Follinger?
Yeah.
That's where you're almost in, Follinger Auditorium.
Well, we started in 228 Natural History Building back in 1984, but we outgrew that fairly quickly, so... Okay. I don't think we'll make it to the Assembly Hall, but...
All right. And, Henry Frain, he's on the other side of the glass. He says, box of candy, chocolate-covered, grasshopper? No, actually, she's a vegetarian, so she's not into chocolate-covered insects.
That's right. Although,
of any sort.
Although my class, we do have an edible insects laboratory. I don't eat them, but other students are free to sample if they will.
Let me get a question here. Someone came that has come in by email, and the listener here would like to know, can you talk about the wheel bug?
Yeah.
Aerolus cristatus?
Right. It's that's a rejuviid. These are called assassin bugs. The assassin bugs are, as the name suggests, kind of predaceous for the most part. Some members of the family are actually blood-sucking parasites, but the wheel bug is it's a fairly large one that was mostly restricted to the southern part of the state for many years, and it's kind of been creeping northward. And last year, what was it, fall 2009, right?
Yeah.
No, fall 2008, was it? Right. It was everywhere. And it was a big surprise to a lot of entomologists who were not used to seeing it in this part of the state. Although, again, it's not unprecedented that it should be here. And they look like something that should be an insect fear film star. They are like something that crawled out of a prehistoric movie set. They're not that ancient, but they look robotic. They have the thorax is kind of topped with a very spiky, spiny kind of arrangement that looks like a wheel, hence the name wheel bug. They're predacious, but they will bite you if you grab them, and it hurts. So I don't know if anyone out there grabbed them. But they're not bloodsuckers. They have relatives that are, including the bloodsucking cone nose, which is a triatoma species that can be a vector or carrier of some human diseases, including American trypanosomiasis or American sleeping sickness, or Chagas disease. But apropos of our earlier conversation, another relative of the wheel bug is called the masked bedbug hunter that feeds on human blood, but only when it's in the belly of a bedbug. They run around in search of bedbugs and suck bedbugs there. So the bedbug's mortal enemy is a relative of the wheel bug. Okay. Now, you won't find wheel bugs in your house, but you usually find them and just in vegetation, roadside vegetation, local forests and fields and the like.
Well, the person, in fact, who wrote it in said he had seen one in Meadowbrook Park.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
said that he'd said he'd never seen one before a year ago when he said saw one in Meadowbrook.
Yeah. Right, and that's that time when everybody was seeing them everywhere. And again, I had not seen one. I've lived here since August 1980 in central Illinois and had only seen them in collections. And then I was seeing them everywhere, too. Quite cool.
Okay, very good.
Well, and they're big. They're like an inch and a quarter long. Mm.
Other questions? Welcome. We got a couple of people here ready to go. Let's talk with someone in Indiana on line four, our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I guess I'd have to add my vote to the science group because every time she's on, I kick myself saying you should have gone ahead and majored in entomology.
That's great.
I'd do like they wanted you to, but I didn't. But, you know, it's just one of those things. It's experiential things. I'm still a boogie. And the thing I wanted to add, two questions actually. One had to do with recording the katydids, crickets, and cicadas. I remember the first time I saw the, I guess the graph photos or whatever they call them with the striations on them of birds. I thought, my God, there's a lot going on in there that only humans are hearing, you know, part of it, that the rest of it, it's, you know, is not happening. I was wondering if the same thing happens. I've been on that site, on the Sound Singing Insects in North America, and it is excellent because I went around the neighborhood talking about that's that kind of cicada, and everybody, oh, God, you know. But anyway, I'd like to know if you could give something in regard to talk about that. And another thing, just as a footnote, is that I think you should come out with another book with colored photos and those kinds of things you just went through, like this is the cousin of that, it does this, bed bugs and that sort of thing. I think there would be a population of people like me that sure buy it, that's for sure.
Well, that's a really good suggestion. But I do have to plug the latest book, I guess, which is called The Earwig's Tale. And it's sort of – it's 26 essays, A through Z, based sort of like a medieval bestiary on contemporary urban insect legends. But it's not colored.
Just the quickie, I had fun with that. And people was going around trying to get people to look inside your ears to see if something actually exists. The other thing is we're talking about the species that – gets under the bark and sets the aggregation. It gets sets a place where the humidity stays a proper percentage. What happens to the people on the outside of the perimeter? Is the humidity much larger in the center, and so that makes it enough on the outside that they can still live? Or is there some kind of, you know, they flap their wings, so to speak, some other kind of mechanical thing?
Well, it's not good to be on the edge. But the way honeybees actually overwinter in these clusters, and they're social species and they're all related to each other, and they actually take turns. They'll form this overwintering cluster. They can vibrate their wings to generate metabolic energy and heat. And that way they can actually keep their hives, or, you know, even when the temperatures are below zero, they can maintain a more or less constant temperature, 60 degrees warmer inside the colony. But they will take turns. They'll rotate, you know, from the edge to the center and back to the edge. But then again, you know, honeybees are kind of a step up behaviorally than a lot of other the insects. In terms of insect communication in frequencies we can't hear, that's quite common. That's, in fact, a really adaptive strategy for a lot of insects to signal. They have a private communication channel if they can figure out a frequency that is not easily perceived by their enemies, among other things. And there's been a very interesting commercial application of that particular phenomenon. There's another site, I think it's called Mosquito Ringtones, where you can download very high-pitched sounds that old people like me can't hear. So students who are in class can have their phones ring, and they can hear them, and I won't be able to hear them. So. So, but it's an interesting – you can see just where your hearing frequency cuts off.
Yeah, that happened in a physics class at IU. The teachers had an oscillator, and he started going. And at the end, only the women were holding their hands up in the air. And the guys looked very confused, you know, like something's wrong here. The whole world has been turned up.
Well, the mosquitoes would have been holding their antennae, too, if they could have.
I'll hop off and let other people.
Thanks for showing up again. Oh, my pleasure.
I thought for sure that I heard something about that, that this thing about irritating high-pitched sounds that only teenagers could hear were being used to actually drive teenagers away. Like if they were hanging out someplace that you didn't want them to hang out, you could play that. The old folks, like us, couldn't hear it, but they could hear it, and it would be annoying, and they would leave.
Well, that multi-purpose, I guess. So, but sometimes machinery gets clogged with male mosquitoes because it happens to vibrate at exactly the frequency that female mosquitoes use to attract males. So, and it's mystifying to the machinery operators why all these male mosquitoes are committing suicide in the grinding gears. But it's because it's there; they can hear that ultrasonic signal that we can't.
All right. Well, let's talk with some other folks here. Urbana is next. Line one. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, two questions. First, a historical question. Isn't it my recollection is that I first heard you on WEFT before.
Yes, you did. Wow. Yeah, you must be a longtime resident. That's that. Well, it was more or less the same time. It was like 1982. No, actually, I think Focus 580 came first. I think it might have been like 83 when I started at WEFT. I used to do a Those Amazing Insects segment on Saturday morning at 10:30 when I thought absolutely nobody was listening to the radio. I guess I was wrong. So,
yeah. And the second question is a little more serious, maybe. What evidence, if any, have you noticed in the way of insect migration, possibly because of climate change?
Well, not so much migration, but there have certainly been clear distribution shifts here and elsewhere. Many, just like we were talking about with the wheel bug, the many species that typically for many, many years were more or less restricted to southern areas are creeping northward, and some of the high altitude species are going to higher altitudes still, and that's a big worry. There's evidence from England. Bumblebees and the flowers they pollinate, bumblebees tend to like colder weather, and there have been some shifts where basically the bumblebee's been driven off the mountain because it's no longer high enough to be cold enough. And there are other places where the flowers have persisted, but the pollinators are no longer there. So we would know more about these distribution changes if we had been a little more conscientious 20 or 30 years ago about mapping the contemporary distributions of insects. But there are a few groups that people have always admired, butterflies and bumblebees, where that we have really good historical records of distributions, and it's very, very clear that not only are they changing and moving kind of northward, but the seasonally they're advancing, they're appearing earlier and persisting later. So that's very hard to come up with an explanation for this occurrence repeatedly in multiple species other than a general warming trend. There's the study that was published about the bumblebees in Britain. The vast majority, there were three species that had shifted their range counter to the predictions of a warmer climate. They'd actually moved, they just more or less expanded everywhere. But the vast majority of species whose distributions were followed moved northward or upward.
Great. Thanks.
All right. Sure
thing.
And thank you. And on to again to another caller. This is somebody up in Sycamore in the northwestern part of the state. Line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have two questions, both of them about bee-type insects. The first is about wasps. And I captured a wasp in a jam jar some time ago and screwed the lid on tight to see how long it could survive. And the answer was, I guess, close to 2 months. It was still alive, and I finally let it go. And I'm absolutely astounded at how such a creature can stay alive without food, without water, and without air for so long.
Well, help? They actually have air. People think that you put them in a jar and you should punch holes in them. It's really, it'd be like you running out of air in Folinger or something. That they can, a jar of air relative to their needs is unlikely to be depleted. So at least, I don't know about 2 months, but certainly for the average length of time that people tend to keep caterpillars in jars to see if they turn into butterflies. But that's commonly people think I have to punch holes in the lid. Not really. So, because it's enough for them. Food and water, that's something else altogether. But some insects have unbelievable powers of persistence, particularly those ectoparasite blood feeders. Bed bugs can live for a year without food. Fleas, too, can live for months and months without food in very dry environments, which is sometimes if you move into an apartment which has been vacant for months, but a dog used to live there, there's suddenly an appearance of fleas, an infestation of fleas, which is mystifying until you realize that they can rest in the pupal stage almost indefinitely until footfalls, the vibration of a moving body triggers their metamorphosis to adulthood.
That is amazing.
Yeah, spiders are also pretty good at starving for a long period. I'm not recommending this as, you know, sort of low-maintenance pets or anything, but it is astonishing how they can scale down their metabolic needs.
Well, the other question I have is something that was triggered by the previous caller about insect migration, and it's been a long time since I've heard anything about the African killer bees that were starting to occupy and corrupt the hives in the southern part of this country. What's the status of how far north they have come?
Well, I think the farthest north, I think that was maybe Memphis. They've made it to Florida, and they're established in Florida. California, there's reports in Nevada. But it's really clear they're not particularly tolerant of Illinois winters or winter in general. They are very, very definitely tropical species. So the worry was that they might hybridize, and they, in fact, have hybridized. But even the hybrids aren't particularly cold hardy. So they have not been. This was, I think, Discover magazine named the 20. Most glaring errors of the 20th century at the end of the century, and the prediction of mass destruction and devastation and, you know, the downfall of American agriculture due to killer bees was one that was did not get realized. But they're, you know, so they need a certain level of moisture. They also need a certain minimum winter temperature. So they are pretty much restricted. I don't think we'll be seeing them anywhere near here anytime soon. And in fact, as long as people learn how to manage them, you know, behaviorally they are different from the Italian bees that are the bees of the most widespread for apiculture. Then they're actually fairly productive, irritable but hardworking, and. They seem to have weathered this most recent wave of colony collapse disorder better than the Italian bees. So there may even be an upside to some of the African genes.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right, very good.
Well, thank you.
Before we find ourselves out of time, you want to talk about the movies that you're going to be showing tomorrow?
You bet. Okay. So doors open at 6 for our insect petting zoo, paste painting, bug scope, fossil. We have a fossil petting zoo for the first time. And you can get up close and personal with an extinct trilobite. And at 7 o'clock, the festival starts. We'll have we'll present the awards for the insect art competition that the schools in the area have participated in. And I'll make some introductory remarks about what's the reality of prehistoric insects and related arthropods and what they're going to see on screen. And in fact, the two movies are not about prehistoric insects. One is about a prehistoric scorpion, which is not an insect, it's an arachnid, and one is about a prehistoric trilobite, which is a trilobite, a whole different class unto itself. But the people in the movies think they're insects, so we call them Prehistoric Insect Fear Film Festival. The first film is from the 50s, a typical big bug film called The Black Scorpion, about a plague of giant black scorpions disrupted that are unleashed from their prehistoric state of suspended animation due to volcanic eruption, and they wreak all kinds of havoc on the Mexican countryside. And the other is a movie called Ice Crawlers. It was originally released as Deep Freeze, which is about an unscrupulous oil company doing drilling in Antarctica and in that way disturbing these prehistoric trilobites that, unlike real trilobites, are enormous and bloodthirsty, vicious land dwellers. And all trilobites that ever occupied the planet were marine and not particularly adept at leaping on people, and certainly not equipped to chew up humans. So, including the team of graduate students that's brought down there by the unscrupulous oil company, because the kids will be naive and they all, well, I won't give it away. But so it's full of all kinds of hilarious, howlingly wrong lines. So they say this, the trilobite, when they recognize what they're dealing with, is 10 million years old. Well, they're off by an order, more than an order of magnitude. They're more like 250 million years old, not 10 million years old. And they also have some of the biology is all wrong. But trilobites, very interesting group of arthropods that you don't see around. So mm-hmm. you may as well use the film as a way to raise trilobite awareness.
So they're arthropods. So does that mean that they're distant relatives of what that we have now?
Well, you know, we have the insects we have that exist today. We have arachnids, the eight-legged external skeleton, jointed-legged creatures.
Like spiders
and ticks and mites and scorpions. And then at that same level of classification, the trilobites are an extinct group, multi-legged, marine. And then one other group that's actually fairly close to the arachnids, called the Xiphosura, which are horseshoe crabs. And they originated about 450 million years ago, and today's horseshoe crab looks pretty much like the horseshoe crabs of 150 million years ago, so it's what we call a living fossil. We don't have them here in Illinois because we don't have beachfront property here in Illinois, oceanfront property. They're marine, and they are kind of on that same – they're in a class by themselves, like insects are in a class by themselves. So some of the classes made it. Some of them didn't. So insects go back about 350 million years. Scorpions go back, which still exists today, to probably more like 400 million years ago. They showed up in the Silurian. And among the extinct arthropods were the giant sea scorpions, Eurypterids, which we don't have anymore. And they were up to 8 feet long. Those must have been pretty impressive.
You
creatures.
Would not want to meet one of those.
No, a giant underwater giant sea scorpion.
8 foot long scorpion. No, I don't think so.
So all kinds of, you know, people love dinosaurs. I'm hoping they love dinosaur arthropods too. Hmm.
Well, we do. We have fossils, we have insect fossils, do mm-hmm. we not? I'm sure that I've seen things like dragonflies.
Actually, we'll show clips from other films about extinct or prehistoric insects, including Monster on the Campus, which is about a professor who is working on Latimeria, the coelacanth, which is a fossil, living fossil fish that was actually rediscovered off the coast of Africa in the 40s. So then the early 50s, this was in the newspaper a lot. So according to this film, this very sloppy lab technique, and a dragonfly ends up feeding on the blood of the coelacanth specimen. And the next scene, you see a 2-foot-wide wingspan dragonfly, which there were. Meganeura was an extinct dragonfly with a 2-foot wingspan, the largest insect ever on the planet that lived in the Carboniferous era. And then, not to spoil the surprise, but eventually the professor ends up reverting to Neanderthal state as he becomes a primitive humanoid as well. So, and we have clips of the deadly mantis, where a giant mantis is disturbed by atomic testing from the its frozen home in the Arctic. And there are prehistoric insects in both versions of King Kong. So prehistoric insects have attracted filmmakers. But the reality, I think, is even more impressive than what they've come up with.
Okay. So, again, this is the Insect Fear Film Festival for 2010, going on now 27 years. The theme, prehistoric insects this time around. This will be tomorrow, taking place in the Follinger Auditorium, starting at 6, with the usual kind of activities to start things off.
And a brand new fossil petting zoo for the first time.
Brand new fossil petting zoo. I don't know if that's quite the, you know, maybe, I don't know how many people who really would want to pet a giant Madagascar hissing cockroach.
Well, you can do that too.
Petting a fossil, that's a rock, isn't it?
It is.
Is it not a rock?
It's a rock, but it's the best we can manage. They've been extinct for 300 million years. What can you do?
How do you manage to keep coming up with subjects for this festival now 27 years? Have you ever done the same thing twice?
Not the same theme. Well, actually, I think we did ants twice, but we may have had a different spin on it the second time. We have shown, I think, only 3 feature films more than once, and at least one occasion is because the film supplier destroyed the print and we had to come up with an extra. But Beginning of the End, we had to show again. It's my all-time favorite insect fear film because it basically starts here in Champaign. So, and then the giant grasshoppers end up walking up the Wrigley Building in Chicago, and drowning in Lake Michigan.
Yes. A fine example of the genre, and that's the one that is one of the – is it the Mission Impossible guy? Or was it,
Peter
is
Grace,
it his brother?
Yeah.
Peter Grace?
Yep, yeah.
He's the one – he plays the heroic entomologist
yes,
in this?
Yes, he is, and he's who utters the line, "You can't drop an atom bomb on Chicago." One of my favorite lines in all of these movies.
All right.
Along with the one from Tarantula where the female scientist named Steve says, "Science is science, but a girl's got to get her hair done."
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, May Barenbaum. She is head of the Department of Entomology at University of Illinois. She is the author of a number of books. The most recent is The Earwig's Tale, A Modern Bestiary of Multi-Legged Legends. And you can also look for her book, Bugs in the System and Their Insects and Their Impact on Human Affairs. It's been around for a while, but that's about all of the ways in which insects intersect with our lives. And you can still get the immortal 99 Gnats, Nits, and Nibblers, published by the University of Illinois Press a long time ago, which is a lot of fun. If you have kids and you're wanting to get them interested in insects, that would be a good thing to do. And stop by the festival tomorrow on the U of I campus. Thanks very much.
Always thank you.
For being here.